Right, thank you, Alan. Yes, it's easy to be presumptuous, isn't it, and think the service is going to finish early this morning. I think it will. I think we're all right. Now, I wanted to get the title of this morning's talk right. I wanted to get my spelling correct. It's the covenant-making God. I thought, get it right, because I could end up with the coven-making God. And I thought, no, that's the wrong message. I could have ended up with the convent-making God. I thought, no. So it's the covenant-making God. And it's part one. Now, that's good, because that means that if it is taking, and I haven't timed, but usually I time my talk beforehand. I do a little rehearsal to see how long it's going to take. I didn't manage to do that this week because it's been so busy being the last week of school and everything else. But the good news about it being a part two is that really I have no excuse for going on too long today, because I can stop it at any point really and say, okay, we're going to save that for later. Part two should be on the 27th of September. So if there's not many people there on the 27th of September, I know I haven't done a very good job with part one. Right, so we're going to talk about the covenant-making God this morning. Now, the Bible is split into two parts, the two testaments. And as Christians, we often talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament. But do we know what the word testament actually means? That's a good question, isn't it, this morning, I think. Looking at it, is that I know the word testament is an anagram of the word statement. Now, there's a few interesting anagrams that sometimes can throw light on the meaning of a word. There's some interesting ones. For example, the Morse code is an anagram of here come dots. That's good, isn't it? Let's see. Soccer player is an anagram of score, leap, cry. That's a good one, isn't it? I'd hate to know what the cricket is an anagram of at the moment, but we'll leave that one. Mother-in-law, that's an anagram of woman Hitler. I'm not saying anything about that one. We will move on, especially with the wedding yesterday and everything else. We don't want to spoil that. But sometimes anagrams can shed light on things, and sometimes obviously they can't, as with the last example. But the word testament is an anagram of the word statement, which I thought, you know, is very interesting. Does that tell us much about the Old Testament and the New Testament? Well, in a way, I think it doesn't, because yes, it is a statement from God, but statement is a very sort of cold and impassionate term. I don't think the New Testament is just a statement from an aloof, distant God. It is the communication with his creation of his love and of his will to eternally save us and reconcile us to himself. God wants to be connected. God isn't a God of just making statements to us. So I think it can say something, but it doesn't go very far. So I think it's a little bit inadequate to say that the word testament just means statement. It is much more than that. It's much more of a living relationship than a communication. So let's look at the etymology of testament. I sort of feel like looking at the... Yeah, thank you. I feel like looking at the etymology of etymology, to be honest, because it's a big word. Okay, tell me exactly what it means. I'd move on fairly quickly. Tim could, I know. But the etymology of the word testament. Well, it comes from the Latin testamentum, okay, which I'm sure many of you knew. That was used in the 14th century to describe the two sections of the Bible. Okay, so that's where we get that word testament from, for the Old and the New Testaments, the Old and New sections of the Bible. It was derived from the Greek word diatheke. Okay, diatheke means covenant, dispensation, and parting will. Now, that I did get very excited about, because I thought this tells me much more about what testament means, about what the Bible stands for, about what God's holy scriptures mean to us. That they are a covenant, it's part of a dispensation, and it has something to do with parting will. Now, the parting will part I will save for part two. But let's first look at what dispensation means. Dispensation, and I'm sure most people have heard the term, and probably like me, they've thought, okay, I've heard the term, I know sort of pretty much what it perhaps means, but only because I've heard it in a context. People talk about, for example, that we live in the dispensation of grace at the moment, that there was a dispensation of law, there was a dispensation of innocence. It's almost like splitting the Christian or the Jewish history into different sections, given what was happening at the time in terms of man's relationship with God. So dispensation is really a religious or social or political system which prevails at a time. So in secular or in a political sense, we could look at the fact that we're currently living in a conservative dispensation. As I say, in terms of Christianity, at the moment we're living within a dispensation of grace. We're living in a time where God's relationship or God's hand to his people is one of grace. If we look back at the time of Adam and Eve in the garden, that was a dispensation of innocence. Grace wasn't needed before the fall. Adam was living in a relationship with God where there was innocence prevailing. So that was called a dispensation of innocence. Now, and there are arguments as to how many dispensations there are. So if you think I'm going to go home and find out, are there seven, are there nine? There's arguments about them, because basically it's how man has decided to split, if you like, the history of man's relationship with God into different sections so that they can talk about them and refer to them. So we could look at the Old and the New Testament as old and new dispensations. Now, if we look at them in these terms, then what it's saying is that there is a difference between them. There is a difference between the new dispensation and the old dispensation. And there are stark contrasts, of course, between the two testaments. If we look at Hebrews 12, 18 to 24, we really get a summing up of the New Testament of the differences between living under the old and living under the new dispensations, if we can call them that. And it says, you have not come to a mountain, this is the Old Testament really, under the law, you've not come to a mountain that can be touched, fire to darkness, gloom and storm, to a trumpet blast or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. So that's the old dispensation, or the dispensation of the law, the Mosaic covenant. But in the new, he says this, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Now, towards the end of this, you can see the contrasts. And this is why this was written within the book of Hebrews, to show that we're no longer under fear, but we're under faith, that there is a new covenant, there is a new relationship, and it is mediated by Jesus. The second meaning of the word diatheke is covenant, and we see it at the last in the last verse of these scriptures in Hebrews. And you may understand what covenant means, you may not. But what I wanted to do really in this morning's message is just to shed more light upon what covenant is. Because the New Testament is very much God's new covenant with us. And obviously, if we're going to understand it fully, then we need to understand what covenant is about. Because covenant, in one word, if you like, is about relationship. There's a definition of the word covenant. And it is this, a binding agreement ratified or sealed, the two words mean the same, ratified or sealed by the shedding of blood, a binding agreement. A covenant is the most sacred of all compacts or agreements. Its significance was understood from the very beginnings of time. Now, you'll hear some people say that the Jews took or borrowed or stole their idea of covenants from other ancient civilizations. But what historians forget is that in the beginning, God. And, you know, some people even say, do you know what the first religion was? There were religions before Judaism, people will say. But people forget that in these terms, religion starts with relationship with God. Well, in that case, the first religion has to be the true one, because God is God. And he didn't say to Adam, this is the birth of Judaism, because Judaism was defined, if you like, with the man Israel. But the true faith, and this is where terms sort of fall short of what the true picture is. Christianity started with Christ. Israel, the nation of Israel, and Judaism started with Israel, with the character Israel, who was Jacob. But the true faith that all those have stemmed from is obviously the same faith as with the living God and his relationship with Adam. So all these things in reality started with God and with Adam. So the first covenant we can find in the book of Genesis, and with Adam and God and Eve, and from then onwards. And what's happened is other civilizations have seen the reality, and they've taken from this, and they have then created their traditions, and they've slightly adjusted them, slightly adapted them. And so there are differences, but the true one was with God in the beginning, not the other way around. Archaeologists and anthropologists have not found evidence of a single ancient civilization or culture that has not practiced some form of blood covenant. And again, the reality of that is because God initiated it at the very beginning. So as the people spread out on the earth, they took the traditions, the reality of what God instigated, and adapted it, and so on. That's why we can find them all over the world in every ancient civilization. That testifies to the fact that they began with an initial source in an initial place, and everybody had wind of that, if you like. And that's because one man, one woman was the start of humanity and mankind. And science builds upon that model. Isn't it amazing? Science has proven today that there are not different races of man. Science has proved that there's one race, that we are all blood related. Isn't that tremendous? And the Bible teems with all the elements that make up the blood covenant. So what does blood covenant signify? Well, for the ancients, it was two individuals that died to self and were reborn as one. That's how they saw it. Two individuals or two parties or two nations died as one, or died as individually, two nations, and were reborn as one. Aristotle said, and I think it might be up there, that it is one soul in two bodies. Henry Clay Trumbull, who's an American clergyman, said this: all over the world, men who were in covenant of blood friendships were ready, or were supposed to be ready, to give not only their lives for each other, but even to give for each other that which was dearer to them than life itself. So they weren't just prepared to give their lives for one another, but even things which were more sacred or more important than their own lives. And in the case of Abraham, with God, he was willing, of course, to give up his son Isaac. The blood covenant is so entrenched in our history that we have many phrases and many terms that are in our language that have stemmed from the traditions, early traditions of the blood covenants. One is, blood is thicker than water. Now, people often think that phrase, blood is thicker than water, means that family is stronger than friendships. But in actual fact, it means completely the reverse. It's saying that blood covenant relationships are stronger than family. The water is the water of the womb. The blood is the blood of the blood covenant. So it's saying the blood covenant, blood brothers, is a stronger bond than just that bond of a family, because they share the waters of the womb. In other words, it's saying because they have chosen to come into this binding agreement, it is a stronger agreement than people who may not even get on just because they've come out of the same womb or because they're related. Another phrase in our language, stick out like a sore thumb, came from the blood covenant. It came from the fact that they would put a little nick on the thumb. They would rub sand or soil into the wound so it would scar deliberately to show that they have come into covenant with someone. Sometimes they would put a tight ring on the thumb to sort of further mark it. So to stick out like a sore thumb was somebody who has cut a covenant with someone. And the word friend actually stems from the traditions of blood covenant. It means a covenant partner, someone that you trust with your life. And today, of course, we use the term friend much more casually than it originally meant. It was a blood friend, a blood covenant partner, an intimate ally. Abraham and Moses were both called by God friends of God, and Jesus calls us his friends. Now, what are the nature of covenants in general? Well, a covenant is voluntary. No relationship of true love can be forced. Okay, so to come into covenant with someone was a voluntary step. But when you came into covenant with someone, it was binding and irrevocable. So you didn't have to come into covenant with someone. You were completely free not to. It was completely voluntary. But if you did, it was then binding. Okay, so we have this these two relationships, if you like. You know, the freedom to or not to, but if you do, it was considered more binding and more important than anything else, really, that there was. Now, there was, at an Elim conference, a chicken and a pig, and the offering basket was coming round, and the chicken and the pigs thought, well, what do we have to give? We've got no money on us. What on earth can we give into this offering? So one of them has the idea and says, well, why don't we give bacon and eggs? Everybody likes bacon and eggs. So they both nodded at this and thought, that's a great idea. We'll give some bacon and eggs when the offering basket comes round. But as it came nearer and nearer, the pig suddenly began to sweat a little bit more and said, well, hang on. Said, what you're giving is an offering, but what I'm doing is a sacrifice. You know, yours is a gesture, but mine's commitment. You know, and this is sort of the difference between, what sometimes we say to each other, you know, I promise to do this or whatever, and what a blood covenant was. A blood covenant was total, absolute commitment. You know, much more that it was not something you could back out of. And usually with covenants, there were conditions. There were blessings for those who kept the covenant, and there were curses if it was broken. There were consequences. There were rewards to both parties who were in covenant with one another. There were benefits, but there were curses and consequences if the covenant was broken. And the biggest consequence was usually death. Let's look at the biblical covenants. There's many examples. The Bible is replete with them. For example, God made covenants with individuals. For example, with Adam and with Noah, with Abraham, with Moses and with David. He made covenants with a nation, Israel. And he made a covenant with all mankind. Part two will focus upon the covenant that he made with all mankind, if you like, with a new covenant, the New Testament. There's many examples of covenants as well in the Bible between individuals. For example, a covenant was made between David and Jonathan. A covenant was made between Jacob and Laban. A covenant was made between Abraham and Abimelech. And the covenants within the Bible are mostly conditional, with blessings and curses attached. But there are also covenants within the Bible which are unconditional. And we will look at certainly one of those in a few moments. And that's one without any blessings and curses attached at all. Now, the biblical and ancient covenants contained many similar elements, which we would expect being
as they all stem from the original idea of the covenant which God instigated. And these elements are as follows. We have, they generally all contain covenant promises, a blood sacrifice, a blood path. I'm going to lapse into saying blood bath, I think, at times, especially thinking about the cricket, you know, the way that's going. But it's a blood path. Oaths, blessings and curses, if it's a conditional covenant. The mingling of blood, the changing of names, the exchange of gifts, a covenant meal, and finally, the element of a witness, a sign or a memorial. Now, it's so handy that Josh and Luma got married yesterday because the wedding is an example of a covenant that people practice today. And within that, we see many of these things. We see a change of names, the exchanging of gifts, a meal, and a sign, such as the ring, being exchanged. Oaths being taken. There's sometimes a bloodbath. It depends how well they get on, really, in the long run, doesn't it? I can see a few people, you know, resonating with that, yeah. So let's take a look at each of these in turn. So the first one, covenant promises. These are the things that the parties commit to. The actual nitty-gritty of what they want to commit to each other. There's three primary reasons why people would come into covenant. One was for protection. This might be particularly between two allied nations that just want to come into a compact or agreement with each other to give each other protection. And you can see that, for example, in Europe. That's why the countries came together after both wars, you know, to try and connect and create a stronger, more protected future. So protection is one reason why people come into covenant, whether individuals or nations or whatever. Another reason was trust. Now, this might happen, for example, between two warring nations that wanted an agreement, an understanding by which they would go on in the future, having had difficult relationships in the past. So sometimes two might come into covenant because of trust. And the other one is love, because of a friendship or because of, as I say, like in the case of Joshua and Luma, marriage. And the covenants would be usually extended to their families at least seven generations historically, although descendants could opt out of the covenant agreement. So let's look at some of the biblical examples of the covenant relating to promises. If we look at the Mosaic covenant in Exodus chapter 19 verses 5 to 8, it says this. God says, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. So God's promise here was that the nation of Israel would be his treasured possession, that he would be God to them, that he would have relationship with them, and that he would make them holy. These were the promises that God was setting down. In turn, the nation promised to keep the Ten Commandments, to keep the law. So there were two sides. And this is the amazing thing, is that when God makes covenant with man, God is saying, I bind myself, I commit myself to this relationship. No backing out. And, you know, often we think about our commitment to God, but God has made his commitment to us. And isn't that wonderful that God would want to come into that sort of binding relationship? He loves us so much that he says, I want to show you how much I love you by committing to it, by binding myself to it. And do you know there are certain things that God cannot do because he has promised and bound himself on oath by swearing upon the highest thing that exists upon himself that he will do it or that he will not do it. And he is tied to that. The central promise of the Noahic covenant. God promised never to send another worldwide flood. In Genesis 9:11, we read this, "I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth." Now that was a condition, was a covenant without conditions, without any elements of condition at all. In other words, God said, it doesn't matter how mankind acts, it doesn't matter how you act, Noah, from this point, I will never do this. A covenant without conditions. God said, this is what I'm saying, and I will not go back on it. God cannot. That's something God cannot do. If you say, is there anything that God can't do? Yes. God can't go back on his word, and God won't go back on his word. Why does he make covenant? Because he wants us to know. He wants us to know his relationship with us. He wants us to know that he will never send a worldwide flood again, because he loves us. You know, that's what entering into marriage is, isn't it? You know, why should people enter into marriage? Why should Josh and Luma get married? They want to show how much they love one another by committing to it, by saying, you know, people say it's just a piece of paper. Yeah, well, why not sign it then? Oh, whoa, you know, it's a bit of a commitment, that one. Yeah, it's a bit more than a piece of paper, isn't it? You know, £10 note's a piece of paper. Some people are going to say, no, technically it's linen. It's not paper. It's linen, which is why it doesn't fall apart in the washing. Yes, it is. It spoils it, doesn't it? You know, money doesn't grow on trees. Oh, yes, it does. Well, no, it doesn't. You know, so anyway, if you watch too much QI, it really sort of messes with your mind, you know. You watch QI to the point you think, right, I don't know what to believe anymore. And then after about 10 series, they suddenly say, do you know that 90% of the facts that we've given on QI aren't correct anymore? You think, well, that's brilliant. Now I don't know what to believe at all. Well, we do, because we have the Bible. And the Bible is an authority greater than QI, I believe. I think I'm pretty safe saying that. I know the presenter of QI, Stephen Fry, won't be too pleased to hear that, but he's not too pleased to listen to Christians anyway. Bless him. Right. So promises of the Abrahamic covenant. God's promises a homeland. He promises the creation of a great nation and a blessing that would extend to every family on earth. Oh, now we're getting into it with the Abrahamic covenant. There's elements of the Abrahamic covenant, many of them, which really go into the New Testament. It's almost like God was thinking, I'll start the New Testament now, Abraham, I can't wait until, you know, and he did really, but it was on faith looking forward rather than on faith looking back. And in fact, if you go back to many of the covenants, including the Adamic one, after the fall, there's many elements of the relationship that God had with Adam, which were really new covenant. God was always looking to the ideal of the new covenant. And in the new covenant, he's looking forward to the ideal of the new heaven and the new earth to come. In Genesis 12, 1-3, God says this to Abraham. The Lord had said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Isn't that amazing? God was establishing a covenant with Abraham. God had found a covenant partner through whom he could make a particular type of covenant. And it was based upon the fact that God wanted to promise with someone that he would send his one and only son to die, with the faith and the belief that he would rise again from the dead. Abraham was that man. Abraham, it was very fundamentally important that Abraham believed and trusted God so much that, number one, he was willing to give up his only son born of the promise out of faith, which was Isaac. But Abraham also had the faith to believe that God could rise Isaac from the dead. And if you don't believe it, go to the story and you'll see that when Abraham is on his way to sacrifice Isaac, he says to a couple of servants, stay here in a short while, we will return. So that was very much God saying, I have found a covenant partner here, someone who I can promise now that as you have been willing to give your son, so I bind myself to say that I am willing and will give mine. And that was the moment that there was no takey-backies, as they say at school. Promises of a marriage covenant. Ooh, we're getting into it now. Okay, Tim, listen up. Okay, promises of a marriage covenant. Has this microphone got louder? Right, okay, promises of a marriage covenant. Future spouses each make vows, okay, which are the promises of the covenant. As I say, Josh and Luma's wedding was perfectly timed. They were going to get married at a different time, but I said, no, 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 you've got to get married the day before this, just to sort of give it a bit more pep, which they agreed to do. That's not true, of course. The promises are the bedrock of the covenant. They are why the covenant is made. They're the very essence and the reasons for it. Right, element number two, the blood sacrifice. Covenants are ratified and sealed by blood, generally. There are exceptions, but generally they're ratified or sealed by blood. The Abrahamic covenant, we had circumcision, which usually involved, I think, bloodshed. I think we'd all probably agree on that without knowing too much more about it. Following the fall, God's relationship with Adam was restored by God through sacrifice of an animal. Now, I was sat in my bath one day, and I was thinking, you know, the devil doesn't really ever come up with any new ideas. He just sees what God's doing and perverts it. And Ecclesiastes says there's nothing new under the sun. So you think, okay, so where did all these other religions come from? Well, the devil looked at the true religion, the true faith, and thought, right, if I can duplicate these, then it will really sort of confuse the picture. When man began to talk, he thought, how can I twist language? And so swear words came. When men used their and women used their hands to sort of be kind to one another and love one another, he thought, right, I can use them maybe to slap and hurt one another. So everything that we have, you can twist and contort. And I sat there in my bath one day and I thought, well, where did the devil get the idea of murder from? And, of course, it's there in the book of Genesis where God, when Adam had fallen and was just about to be separated from God, in a spiritual sense, was separated from God because of the act of sin and rebellion that he'd committed against him. God took an animal and sacrificed it and covered him and them, Adam and Eve, with the skins of that animal. And it wasn't because God preferred fur to the leafy things that Adam and Eve had made. And the Bible doesn't say this is a covenant, blah, de, blah, de, blah. But it was. God was saying, your sin has distanced you from me. The path back to me is through blood. He was teaching Adam about covenant and about covering of blood. And I believe the devil saw that and thought, oh, I could twist that. Maybe I can get man to do that to man. And within a short time, we have Cain and Abel and the one brother, killing the other one. So straight away, God was teaching Adam a fundamental principle of covenant, that it is by the shedding of blood. Why is it ratified by blood? Well, that's because the blood represents the life of the covenant partners. Leviticus 17:11 says, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. So why does blood make atonement for our lives? Because God says it represents your life. When God sacrificed that animal to cover Adam and Eve with the skins, he was saying, your rebellion, the price of your rebellion is death, but I will accept the sacrifice of this animal instead of you to bring you back into relationship. So you're brought back into relationship with me by the blood, but that blood, you need to know, represents your blood, because that represents, that's the price and the consequence of your sin. So it was a twofold message. On the one hand, it was saying, I love you to bring you back into covenant. On the other hand, it was saying, you have to realize that your sin is awful. Awful enough that it costs life. It should have cost your own, but I love you so much that I will take in your stead an animal. Now, an animal wasn't sufficient ever to make up that gap between God and man, but the blood of that animal was representative of the blood of one who would make up that gap, and that was Christ only. There's only ever been one sacrifice that has been enough. and that is Christ. All the other sacrifices were just signposts saying, we're looking to that one. Just as we took the bread and the wine this morning, the wine is representative of blood, which points back to the sacrifice that mattered in our lives. Today, scientists have confirmed this revelation that the life of a creature is in the blood. Now, Leviticus 17:11 makes quite a profound scientific statement. When you think about it, saying the essence of who we are is in our blood. Because today we know that that is absolutely scientifically true. Our DNA, our chromosomes, all our genetic information is in there that determines who we are. Detectives identify criminals just through a drop of blood. Paternity cases are settled by it. Doctors understand how our organs function by analysing our blood, how healthy we are by analysing our blood, and it makes us the unique people that we are. Our blood is as unique to us as any fingerprint is. Blood made oaths very serious. Parties swore upon their own lives and upon their own relatives' lives when they came into covenant with one another. In the Noahic covenant, it was established after Noah had sacrificed animals to God. Again, if you want to see the detail, read the account. Noah came out of the ark. He had clean and unclean animals. And if you read the story, he had many more. I think it was sevenfold more clean animals than unclean. And you think, why was that? It was because the essence and idea of blood covenant relationships was already there. Whether it was in Noah's mind or whether God had preempted it, you know, I'm not sure. But when Noah came off, his heart was to sort of give something to God. So what did he give? He sacrificed some of the clean animals. I wouldn't love to have been one of those animals, but it would have been amazing, wouldn't it? Can you imagine if animals could talk? You know, one of the cows coming off the ark going, wow, you know, out of all the cows on earth, I'm sort of one of 14 or whatever that survived. Isn't this fantastic? What's Noah doing? Well, put the knife down, Noah, you know. You've just saved me from all this storm, and now you're going to kill me. And Noah sacrificed to God, and God smelt the aroma, and he said it was a pleasing aroma. Why? Why was it a pleasing aroma? It wasn't bacon. It was beef. It was a pleasing aroma because God saw the faith of the covenant. God saw that in the essence of sacrifice, blood was shed. It was within Noah's heart, and God would have taught him this at some point, it was in Noah's heart to know that by the shedding of blood, it was pleasing to God because it was Noah saying, my relationship with you is established through the shedding of blood. Ultimately, of course, through Christ. And so based upon that, God was moved and then he established his covenant with Noah. After the sacrifice of those animals, he then came into covenant with Noah, and that's when he said to him, these are the terms of my covenant, these are the promises, and one of those promises was that I will never again send a worldwide flood. We read in Genesis 8, 20 and 21, Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. In the marriage covenant, the principle of the shedding of blood is here also. Now I'm going to try and tread very carefully over the next sort of couple of minutes. As I say, the principle of the shedding of blood is in the marriage covenant. The hymen, which is a tissue containing blood vessels, lines the vaginal opening. In theory, therefore, especially when making love for the first time, small amounts of blood could be shed. This is in theory. You know, in practice, it often doesn't happen. But the theory is there. The principle is there. And the principle is one that's recognized even by law, because in marriage, the marriage covenant isn't fully ratified in the eyes of the law until it has been consummated. And you know, isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing that you're not truly married until you've actually had intercourse? Whatever that is, we'll move on. Far too much of that. Number three, the blood path. Now, this was something that is, you might be sort of, might be less well known by many of us. Now, I will finish soon. I'm looking at this. I'm on page 12 of 24. So I'm certainly going to save, half of this for next time. So I will finish with this page. It'll take another couple of minutes, that's all. And you'll have the rest, God willing, on the 27th of September. So element number three, the blood path. The blood path was a blood-stained route that was created during the cutting of some covenants. With some covenants, and this is how the Abrahamic covenant with Abraham and God was actually ratified or sealed. God instructed Abraham to take certain animals and slice them in half, and the two halves were put opposite each other to create a wall of blood on either side, and obviously that would create a path of blood in the middle. And if you read the account, God moves through the pieces. In other words, he himself was cutting covenant with Abraham. And this is why the Abrahamic covenant was just so important, because it was the basis of the new covenant. This is where, out of interest, the red carpet comes from. The red carpet was this blood path, or representative of it. When King David brought the ark into Jerusalem, it says that he sacrificed animals at the start and at the end of his procession of the ark into Jerusalem. And in fact, many Bible commentators, it depends how you sort of read it, but it says after six paces, he sacrificed the first one. And by the reading of it, it's unclear as to whether it's every six paces or just the first six and the last six. Some commentators believe that at every six paces, he sacrificed an animal before the ark. But either way, there was blood along that procession. And the final element then I'll cover today is element four, that of oaths. Now, these were taken by both parties. And if we look at, for example, how a court of law operates, we have both the defendant and the witness. They make promises to tell the truth. So the oath was slightly different to the promises made within the covenant. The promises were the nitty-gritty of what the two sides were committing to do, but the oath was basically saying, I swear that I will keep it. Now, within a court of law, these are very separate to the actual evidence they give. It comes before, as I say, their giving of witness statements and so on, but they start by saying, I promise that I will tell the truth, and they understand that there are consequences, severe consequences, if they then lie or don't stick to what they've said. The oaths of a covenant were then promising to follow the terms of the covenant, therefore. But they were often interlinked with the promises as well. So sometimes they were hard to separate. And they were said in the presence of witnesses. And sometimes, like in a court of law, they invoked a divine witness. In a court of law, we don't just swear to tell the truth before all the witnesses and the judge and the jury and so on. But often we invoke the divine witness. We say, I swear by Almighty God that I will tell the truth. So, next time I speak anyway, I will come back to looking at the other elements of the covenant and how covenants, the one thing I didn't mention at the start was covenants could be agreed by people that were equal, parties that were equal or unequal. And we have a God, and this is the wonder, really, in which I want to, the context I want to put it in this morning, is that we have a God who is far bigger than anything we could possibly imagine, and we are far smaller than anything we can probably possibly imagine as well. And yet we have a God who loves us so much and is, and not only notices us, but wants to come into this wonderful relationship with us, which is based upon such trust that it's unbreakable. That there would be the highest consequences for breaking it. And God has put forward his hand in each of our lives and said, I want to restore you, I want to come into relationship with you, and I want to love you so powerfully that I want to commit to it. I want to stretch out my hand and bind myself to you by my word and by my pledge. And I show this by the cutting of a covenant with you. And that covenant is cut through the blood of my Son, Jesus Christ, for you on the cross, so that you would not only have salvation, but know that I am absolutely bound and committed to it, that heaven and earth and nothing else, as Paul said, can separate us from the love of God. Why? Because God himself has sworn by himself that he is in covenant relationship with us.